Okay? So, of course, the argument here is going to have an ironic form, since the claim of sense certainty is going to be that it's the richest form of knowledge and it's going to be the most empty. And that's not going to be accidental, that inversion. The structure of the argument is going to have a certain irony to it, because it starts out by saying at the very beginning, paragraph 91, that the hope is that this is going to be the richest kind of knowledge. It's going to not be bounded in any way. It's going to be, as I kept saying, unconditioned, immediate, full, complete. And then it turns out to be the emptiest kind of knowledge. So the very desire, you might say, for wealth turns out to be a sure road to poverty. If only that was true. And paragraph 94 says, but let's stop philosophically arguing about sense certainty. Let us now turn to phenomenology. So he, again, explicit distinction between the philosophical setup, right, and the phenomenological analysis. We don't have, he says we don't have to reflect and ponder whether it's true or not. Let's just consider the way it presents itself. And then it starts with the what is this? And it says, now is night. And when Heidegger does this in his lectures on the phenomenology, he has a lot of fun with this moment, since he writes on the board, now is night. And he says, when I came back the next day, the cleaning man had been here, and he had seen this, and he went like this. So even the cleaning man knows the truth of sense certainty. Well, as apocryphal as that is, of course, Hegel's argument in paragraph 95, that we write it down, and we say now is night, and we come back 12 hours later, suddenly, that is no longer true. And you think, the claim is, the truth can't be lost by having been written down, because it seems now to be true that now is day. And that, the thought then echoes to us, thinking about sense certainty, that something about the now allows itself to be true of different nows. Now is day, now is night, now is 9 o'clock. And that therefore, the now itself seems to have in itself the very thing that sense certainty wanted to avoid, namely something negative about it, in the respect that it can be the negative of each of its instances, right? And only by being negative, being not night, can it become now is day. But that's to say that it cannot be reduced to any of its instances. But if it can't be reduced to any of its instances, then the now is not a determinate particular, but a universal. So, to sense certainty's surprise, it means to say something concrete and particular, but in uttering the now, it says something universal. Now, I'm going to come back in a moment to say something about this idea that it's the universal, because we don't now think of, nor did Hegel in the Encyclopedia think, that now is a universal term. It's an indexical, and I'll say a word about indexicals and universals in a moment. But for the moment, let's pretend it's a universal. That is, whatever is the case, and it doesn't matter for the particular things I want to talk about, what's important about now if it's meant as an indicator of a determinacy is that it can be used of multiple particular instances. Now, you want to say, wait a minute. Sensei said, wait a minute. I wasn't talking about language. Yeah, maybe the word now or the concept now. You know, what I meant was, what I intended was this now. So the puzzle now happens, so there's a kind of puzzle here because it looks as if, this puzzle is going to come back, that language betrays sense certainty. And I suggested at the very beginning that language would betray sense certainty. That's why it's sense certainty. It thinks it can somehow get past the mediations of language. But Hegel wants to say no. And again, is this going to be question begging? Is the use of language here going to be question begging? This is one of the arguments I'm going to have to come back to. There's a whole claim that in asking sense certainty to write this down, in forcing it to put its thought in language, that it is necessarily therefore being forced to mediate by language what it claims cannot be mediated. Hegel wants to say, in opposition to sense certainty, language is the more truthful. And language is the more truthful because it is true that the concept now is something that is usable, reapplicable to multiple instances, and therefore, in that sense, a universal. Well, is it the case that we are being unfair, sense certainty here? As it were, forcing it to speak. Is this, as I suggested, a form of phenomenological coercion? Well, ask yourself this question first. Why does Hegel choose this, he here, now. I.
Come back.
This here, now. Why does he use this here, now as his terms for trying to understand or get inside sense certainty? Looks as if, and I think that's right, that if anything is going to, as it were, correspond to what we imagine the notion of immediacy must signify, it's got to be the here and the now. Right? That space and time, and the simplest versions of the here and the now, let's call it the present to me. So the notion of the this is the wildest fantasy of pure presence. Right? Nothing, since space and time are what the context we know from Kant, and of course much of this is going to concern Kant in this chapter, much of this is going to be a repetition of the transcendental aesthetic, we'll come back to that, of setting up space and time as the ultimate framework in which we experience things. But if sense certainty is going to be able to have any chance of, as it were, satisfying its imaginary, it's going to have to be through the spatial and temporal forms of pure presence. And it does, and what it wants out of pure presence is determinacy. Remember, the idea of uncertainty is not a mystical state of oneness with the universe, although that's what it more or less ends up as. It ends up saying nothing. It ends up as just saying being, because it has no terms for its own determinacy. But he begins with the this because the this is the imaginary that I am immediately aware of something, touching it. So the terms here and now look to be because they are indicators, if you wish, of presence look to be the only terms that he could use that wouldn't be question begging. That is, they capture what is wanted here. So hence the terms themselves look like they're the right terms, but yet nonetheless there are bits of language. So is sense certainty, is there being a question begging with respect to language? And there's a whole lot of, especially Derridean literature, arguing that of course it's question making. Why deconstructionists want to argue that, I don't know. The right response to that argument is given by Pippin in his book on page 119. And the question that Pippin rightly asked, the argument against Hegel would take the following form. Is Hegel begging the question here by presupposing that a form of consciousness must be able to say what it means for it to be able to mean at all? Let me repeat. That's looks like the thesis that's at stake here. Must a form of consciousness be able to say what it means in order to be able to mean at all? Now, if that were true, and some general thesis about the relationship between language and experience were being introduced here, then we would, I think, expect Hegel to make much more of it than he does. And we would especially expect that in the following chapters, a kind of language test, can you say it, can you express it, would kind of recur, and then Hegel would justify this. Never happens again. Hegel never uses language in this way, doesn't have an expressibility thesis. So what are we supposed to suppose here? I take it that the argument is, and now I'll quote Pippin, is that the impossibility of a direct apprehension of a determinate object is shown to be a consequence of the restrictions inherent in the kind of putative experience itself. Namely, it's a consequence of the lack of that experience containing any determining capacity. Because the problem here is the indeterminacy, right? The problem is, I mean to say, now is night, but I cannot determine that, right? Because I'm not allowing that there are any determining capacities. Right? And it's because sense certainty takes away, strips away all the determining capacities, whether they are linguistic or not, that makes the experience essentially indeterminate. So all that sense certainty could experience would be such an indeterminate presence. Because it doesn't, it imagines, right, the fantasy. The question is, could there be an experience of the kind that sense certainty is imagining, that has the concreteness that it's imagining, but with everything else withdrawn, with no concept, with no language, with no setting up of context? Everything that would give the experience its determinacy has been withdrawn, but if it's been withdrawn, then the experience itself is indeterminate. It's not that it can't express what it means. It can't mean what it's imagining, because what it's imagining is something determinate, and determinacy requires a lot of stuff. That's what we're going to learn. Determinacy, to get to this, requires a lot of practice. It requires concepts and handling indexicals, and knowing about reapplication of them and the like. So the thought here is that there can be, given what sense certainty has available, no determinate relationship to an object. That given just opening your eyes, so to speak, does not itself generate a determinate relationship to an object. And therefore, nothing about the notion of experience here has been established. So the difficulty of expressing a sense certain experience in language is the difficulty it is because sense certainty defined experience is necessarily indeterminate. It is indeterminate. That that's why. And because it is indeterminate, then the reference to language here does not play a justificatory role, but merely an explanatory role. So the use of language here is not question begging in any problematic sense. Rather, and now we can see what Hegel was thinking when he says language is the truer, namely what language is showing is the indeterminacy of sense certainty's actual experience. That is its experience that's indeterminate. Right? And that's because there's nothing within its account of what makes experience possible. Namely, nothing makes it possible, it's opening your eyes. That could generate determinacy. Even, we'll get to a minimal attempt. I mean, because the minimum one needed that I always think about when I read this chapter is one of the great, great concepts that's not been philosophically worked adequately is attending. What sense certainty wants to do is to attend, to pay attention to a particular. But attending is a very, very complicated mental act. Huge footnote on attention. It's the primary form of self-determination. Okay. So the problem, the reason why when sense certainty says now, it ends up saying the universal is because that's all it has at its disposal. It has no means of getting to the very thing it wants. Okay. Now, Hegel is not claiming that we cannot be aware of particular thises. He's not claiming that in being aware of particular thises, we become aware of them via our senses. He's simply claiming that sense certainty's way of thinking about that is mistaken. And that mistake then gets repeated with the here, same argument, right? Here is the student, here's the blackboard, right? Here can be any here depending on where I am. Ah, you say. Well, then let's think about the I. And that's just what Hegel suggests. He moves in paragraph 100 to the I. And says that now is day. So what happens now, right? What we've done is not make the object essence. We've made the object inessential. And we're now making the I essential, the state of sense certainty. Okay, so we're testing out the other side of the structure. And now we'll try to say, now is day, because I see it. So the day is index to my perceiving it. I see day. And I'm on the telephone, and my friend in Australia says, oh, no, man. Now is night. I see night. Well, again, the problem here is if you don't, the I now is what? Simply an attempt to index the sense certain moment. It's supposed to be the minimal unit, right? So again, it holds of every possible I. Everyone's entitled to say I, right? Something that we know Descartes counts on. The discourse on method. So the problem turns out to be the same with I. Well, of course, it is the case that neither here or now or I are universals. Universals are what we think of as concepts, and therefore we tend to think of I here and now as indexicals. And Hegel says this, if you want to check paragraph 418 of the encyclopedia. He came to realize that his formulations here were not quite adequate. So indexicals, what's the difference between an indexical and a universal?
Indexicals are tied to the moment of speaking. So,
yep.
In a way, the universals are. I mean, I can say cat at any time. There's nothing peculiar about the time or place or the context of saying cat that allows the concept to form it. The function of classifying the thing with now, here, this, I, the context dependent.
Right. And not only the context dependent, but we may say that the very nature of indexicals is for the sake of generating context of utterance. That's what they do. You say that indexicals don't have a meaning in the way concept has a meaning. A cat is something with, however many legs cats have, four or so, and, it's rather, we say, indexicals have a certain use rather than a meaning. And their use is a way of picking out a context of utterance, and therefore what we are aware of, particularly aware of in sense certainty, varies with context. And therefore, what sense certainty lacks is any way of constituting a context of awareness or a context of utterance that is determining. That is, it wants to use, if I might put it this way, it wants to use the logical powers of this here, now, I, without incurring any of the responsibilities that go along with the employment of those powers. The powers are, of course, to generate the notion of something that should be present. So it wants indexicals, but without acknowledging that they are, in fact, they're concepts with a, they are terms that have a certain set of uses, that their uses are like singular descriptive references, the dog in the manger, say, in a variety of ways. For example, a change of context entails a change of reference. Secondly, a definite description, the blank, requires completion with a predicate, but this requires completion as well, that is, they're incomplete expressions. They have plural forms. They invoke a conceptual scheme that allows one to make inferences, even minimal inferences. If something is this, then it is not that. If it is I, then it's speaking, then it's not you. I mean, so there are some inferential powers and the like. All of this is very nicely covered in an article by William de Vries on Hegel on reference knowledge. Okay, so Hegel says he's talking about universals, but what he's talking about, properly speaking, up to now, are really indexicals. But the same point holds, because indexicals are multiply usable. And they are indifferent to any particular context, and they get their sense from their context of usage, this here now. And they do that by being, as I suggested, context generated.
Can I ask,
yeah.
Just because I want to make sure I got it straight, it seemed as though I heard you say two things that might just be tired. It seemed on the one hand that language works by just expressing the indeterminacy that's in sense certainty. You said moments ago. So that language is not the problem. Language is just simply the best demonstration or manifestation of the indeterminacy that's already in what it means to be sense certain. On the other hand, when I heard you respond to his definition of indexicals, it seemed as though you were attributing to indexicals a performative force of a certain kind,
yeah,
which was to bestow context.
That's right.
And so it can't be that language is, that's trying to reconcile those two things. If language is just expressive of an indeterminacy and not bringing it into being, how does that reconcile with what you're saying indexicals do here, which is make a context? Like, I think that's partly what Hegel means when he talks about the propositional force of these sentences.
It's
part of Heidegger's take on this too.
Right. And so the thought has to be both sides, right? We have to have both sides. That what sense certainty doesn't know, right, is that if it were to get any determinacy, it would have to use indexicals in the ordinary way, that it would have to depend upon language. Right? But it thinks it has access just by virtue of the terms now and here to a now and here, which are not now being used, but we might say quoted. So the problem with sense certainty is it doesn't use the indexicals, it quotes them. Imagining that that's a content, that now is a content, namely the presence, rather than an act of determining a context which gives or makes things present.
So language doesn't, in a weird way, it does turn out to be the problem.
No, the problem is activity. What's
that mean?
Of course, and language is a version of that. But we knew that. That's right. So everything about consciousness, we're going to find this over and over again, right, is that consciousness wants determinacy without determining activity, the activity of consciousness. the concept of an object determined by a apperceptive self-awareness. Right? That's the whole thing about self-consciousness. It is the determining of a concept of an object and therefore generates an epistemic space with a palpable profile. Sense certainty wants none of that. So I was only bringing in the question of indexicals for people who not unreasonably think that the word I should not be lumped along with the words cat and dog and be called a universal. Okay, so the original attempt fails. So Hegel says, well, let's see if we can maybe make the notion of sense certainty work by putting the two moments together. And now something like an attending happens, namely something that occurs at the very opening of Wittgenstein's investigations, namely an act of pure ostension, pointing. You can think of it as a mental pointing, which I think of as attending. And the thought here is if we put together the I with the this here now and put it all in one, then we might be able to get that experience of sense certainty. And the trick here is, if I may put it this way, it has to be very, very, very fast. I see this here now. Gone! Okay. Well, but that is what his argument is. That's exactly Hegel's argument here, because that idea of putting it all together, again, must be putting it together without any actual determining. So if I were willing to determine and say, this hour, in this room, I could relax. Right? Then I'd have a time and a place. I have everything I need. But because the this here now are not thought of as having any structuring capacities, but meant to be pure designations of pure presence, right? Then all they can do is indeterminately pick out a moment, and the indeterminacy of that moment is that the now is already past. So Hegel argues, and I take it what even for him must have been a little linguistic joke, that the now is a has-been. That's what he says. And it is a has-been, which is also going to turn out to be the notion of essence, which is to say the now is not now. But the now is something that always comes about as already past. So that, in pointing it out, paragraph 107, I point out the now, and it is asserted to be the truth. I point it out, however, as something that has been, or as something that has been superseded. I set aside the first truth. I now assert as the second truth that it has been, that it is superseded, but what has been is not. I set aside the second truth, its having been, is its supersession, and thereby negate the negation of the now, and thus return to the first assertion that the now is. The now and the pointing out of the now are thus constituted that neither one nor the other is something immediate and simple, but a movement which contains various moments. So, the thought here, which he puts slightly more eloquently in the Encyclopedia 259, the Zusatz. Zusatz are little sections, additions, at the end of everything in Hegel. The actual material stuff is incomprehensible, but then he has these additions and comments, and they're helpful. And here is his definition of the present in the Encyclopedia. He says the present is, and this is what he's just argued, now he's laying it out more logically, he says the present is only because the past is not. The being of the now has the determination of not being. And the not being of the now is it the not being of its being is the future. The present is this negative unity. I know you read the rest and I'll put it on the board. Formula of it. The not being replaced by the now is the past. The being of not being contained in the present is the future. If one considers time positively, one can therefore say that only the present is, but the concrete present is the result of the past and is pregnant with the future. So the logical form of the now for Hegel is, and it just is now as, so the now is going to be defined by a series of negations. Now as not no longer and not yet. So the now is composed of two negations of negations. Right? The past is the no longer, and the future is the not yet, and the present is the not no longer and the not yet. That is, there's no. So he's trying to show here, if you're a Husserlian, you may say that the present is a moment of retention of the past and a protension towards the future. If you're a Kantian, you'll say it includes the reproductive imagination and the recognition of the object and the concept. And if you're a Heideggerian, you'll say it's ecstatic temporality. What all these accounts share is they do not begin from presence. They all view the present as something that is generated as a relational moment between a past and a future. And it's only in light of, as he says, as a result of a past and a pregnancy with a future, that there is any now. So Hegel's first thought here about the now is that it is the pointing out of it, and this comes about, Hegel says, absolutely clear, he thinks he generates this not crazy logical account of the meaning of presence phenomenologically from the experience of losing the now. That is, the only way I can eventually get to the now is to acknowledge the idea that the now that I had is a has-been, and the now that will come about is not yet, and that therefore, by relating myself to these two nows, I can have a now. So the now comes out of the experience of the loss of presence. Or as he says, it's the discovery that it's a movement. That now is to be experienced in its passing and its loss. And that, he says, the pointing out of the now is thus likewise itself the movement which expresses what the now is in truth. Namely, a result. The now, the simplest, we started out an hour ago saying, the simplest indicator of the present cannot be simple, it must be a result. And if the now is a result, then you can bet your bottom dollar everything's going to be a result. Right? That there's nothing, if we can't have now without two double negations, then nothing else is going to be any logically simpler than that. And that's learning that the now is a certain power within this context and constituted. Now, the notion of here is, in fact, in a way, to me, much more interesting, because much more anthropological. Paragraph 108. And I don't know why commentators don't mention how anthropological it is. He says, what I mean by anthropological is, this is very unlike what Kant says about space, which is, you know, a bit Newtonian, a bit geometrical. He says here, the here pointed out, to which I hold fast, is similarly a this here, which in fact is not this here, but a before and behind, and a below, above and below, a right and a left. Anything curious about those three sets? Yeah, body, not just any old body, what body? Yeah, it's the human body. They are indexed to the upright, forward-looking human posture. The before and behind, you've got to have eyes set in my head that look forward. And I guess there's, you know, some animals have them out here, you know, so on, and right and left, we know from those who did Kant last year and those who didn't, well, I can't do it now. The problem about right and left is they are qualitatively identical, and the only difference between right and left is that they're right and left. That right and leftness are irreducible to anything else, that they are, in that sense, primitive concepts, and at least above and below, as used here, right, assumes a standpoint. So the notion of this here, and this seems to me right, that although eventually, you know, you are, you know, you come sometimes you come across a map that says you are here, and you just shrug. Because, of course, you know you're there. But where the hell are you, right? And it doesn't help, right? So the coordination between the map and the body doesn't work, right? Of course, I'm always here. Where else could I be? But that's Hegel's point, that the notion of here-ness is already going to be regimented, the here, to some indicator of my bodily presence. So that the primitive notion of space and pointing out depends upon, let's call it, the primitive anthropology of visual space and a gentle space projected upon the moving human body. The minimal notion of spatiality possible for perceptual awareness. Okay. So it turns out that both here and now require space and time for their condition of possibility. That, and this is exactly the argument, of course, of Kant's transcendental aesthetic when he says that space and time are intuitions, that they are wholes of which particular moments are parts. So you can't start with a now and you can't start with a here. Rather, the now is composed of many nows, here of many heres. Hegel now says paragraph 109 that it is clear that the dialectic of sense certainty is nothing else but the simple history of its movement or of its experience. This is why the natural consciousness, too, is always reaching this result, learning from experience what is true in it, but equally it is always forgetting it and starting the movement all over again. That is sense certainty. And this is really where I began. So it's not a bad moment to end on. Sense certainty has no content. It has no content because it doesn't allow any determinacy. So the only thing sense certainty, because it denies structure. That's where we started. So when Hegel says the content of sense certainty is its history, that is, it's its learning that it is contentless. And hence, all one can say about sense certainty, because it can say nothing, because it has no content, so all that you can say about sense certainty is that history by which it experiences its loss of its pure now, pure here, pure I. It then goes to the moment when it tries to put it all together. I see this now, kind of speedy moment. I guess you take enough speed. You can just think. Oh, yeah. You had that moment, eh? I'm just okay. Less we know the better. And then losing that, and in losing that, discovering that this structure is required. That is, we can only have the now by the double negation of the not yet, and the not no longer. And we can only have the here by acknowledging the determinacy of the human body itself. that it has a fundamental structuring and orienting capacity. Now, the best example of the latter are Barnett Newman's Zip paintings. People always are surprised at how a single stripe in a color field can be so powerful. But it is clear why the zips that are vertical work and the ones that are horizontal don't. Because the horizontal ones generate the notion of horizon, perspective, all the things that he doesn't want. The beauty of the Zip painting is it realizes that a vertical line is itself a symbol for the entire uprising of the human and its creation of spatiality. So when we look at the Zip, and this is what, of course, Barnett Newman intends by these paintings, we feel as if we are experiencing the birth or the origin of meaning. And he gives them these really heavyweight biblical titles to tell you, in the beginning, Abraham, you know, all this stuff, trying to say this is the emergence of meaning itself. But I want to say it's not the emergence of meaning because there are two colors in the world. The emergence of meaning because there is the upright human being, face forward, left and right, above and below. Immensely powerful.
This anthropological interpretation is interesting. But I'm not sure whether Hegel is really speaks about human body, because what I understand this here is like he points out here.
No. Look. Here, I mean, read the words. Here is before and behind, above and below,
yeah.
Right and left.
Yeah. I can explain that like. I see here it should be a point, and when as an observer, say, when I see this point, I want to point out this point, but I never can point out a point. It always are some points before and below, right and left, up and down. So actually, it's not a human body, but it's also like an objective observer.
That's already too much. Right? I'm looking for the minimum conditions of spatiality. Of course, you're right that these are also objective ones, but I'm suggesting, and Hegel's suggesting, that in order to utter here, we're going to have to have at least those six operators. And I'm suggesting those six operators just are the operators of what it is to have a human body in spatial terms. Right? He could have said, what concepts? That here has to be relative to every other space. But he doesn't say that. That's the point I'm making, that he very carefully doesn't say space is a whole and every space is related. He could have made a logical story. But instead, he very carefully picks out human terms. And this is underlined, and now to go to the, you know, the joke at the end, this is underlined by the fact, right, that he says, if we turn to practice, but this is not like if we turn to practice. That's so to speak, the feint. That these mysteries are not so mysterious, and that the animals do not just stand idly in front of sensuous things as these possess. It should be essence. And you always have to look at Miller. He says weird things about essence. He kind of intrinsic being. It's essence. As if these possess essence, but despairing of their reality and completely assured of their nothingness, they fall to without ceremony and eat them up. And all nature, like the animals, celebrates this open mystery, which teach the truth about sensuous things. What's that truth? Are we eat them? Well, yeah. What's the truth? What he's pointing to? Kind of nice. It's an open mystery. Don't be puzzled by it. Certainly, the first thing we'll say is they're transient and contingent. Absolutely. That they are not essential things at all. That's the first thing we say. Absolutely. That there's a fetishism by saying, you know, what is sense certainty imagining? To imagine that this is what, as it were, saved my soul. Sense certainty, something of me. So the first thing is, yeah, we're transient. But we're transient too. So being transient isn't the worst thing that can happen. What else? What does the animal do with it? So, what's the story there?
It's essential experience.
Well, it is essential, but then that disappears. It just gets eaten up. Yeah?
Turns it into itself.
Turns it into itself. That's certainly what it does. And what's important about that? What's happening when it does that? It's certainly negating it. And what's important about that? It's using it. It has a purpose. It's caught up in a series of practical purposes. So the sensuous thing isn't something that we just look at. It's going to get its meaning in another three chapters. Or if you want, from being, being in time, from being in a circuit of objects that are related to one another by the purposes they fulfill in our practical lives. So we might say, if there's a motto that's going to be pressing us forward, if I can use a motto from one of my favorite writers, McMurray, all knowledge is for the sake of action. That knowledge belongs within a context in which we are practical beings, and we look at things not for the sake of just looking at them, although we have experiences of beauty. That's a bit of a puzzle. But that's the experience of mere looking. Mostly, looking is caught up as part of a practical experience. And that's what the animal knows. It doesn't just stand looking. It puts it to use. So he's suggesting here that we are already caught up, and it's going to take us a while to get past this, in a fetishism of the contemplative perspective, as if perceiving or knowing or looking for the highest human activity. Okay. Questions? Ideas, thoughts, anxieties. Okay, take it. Yeah.
Well, I was wondering how you reconcile reading this as a genealogy, if you think that he's forcing sense certainty to speak, and he's not just looking on.
We force it into a phenomenological structure. Yeah.
So I thought genealogy was like just descriptive. Right?
Phenomenology is descriptive in that this structure itself, we watch it perform. So once we agree that it has a structure, even if it denies it has a structure, then we don't have to have a criterion. We can simply ask if, in its own terms, it matches its sense certainty with an awareness of a this. That is, does the experience deliver determinacy? That's what we're asking. And what we discovered is, looking at its performing that claim, that it turns into the very opposite. The genealogy is going to be the whole of consciousness is going to be genealogy itself consciousness, and it's a phenomenological genealogy, a re-achieving of that and therefore redetermining its meaning by its phenomenological placement. Okay, a few practical matters. First, I actually left your commentaries at home, so I'll try to bring them in tomorrow. If not, I'll bring them in next week. I get group 10 this week, Rossio. I get group 10. Rossio gets anyone else who wants to hand things in. We will start force and understanding next week. We should be able to do perception in an hour. I'm always optimistic. But now, I mean, think about this. You've been very quiet today. Think about the lecture. We can start next week with questions if you wish. We can kind of think about, come back and see if you really got it clear. Okay? Good.